This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you back here as we continue into hour number two of the show. The producers for this program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and at the controls, Henry Frayne. Well, in recent years, certainly here in the United States, the government, police, have been dealing with the threat of terrorism. And it's something that certainly the countries of Europe have dealt with, and there is a much longer history in Europe than there is in the United States. And we thought that it might be interesting to talk a little bit about how things are different as law enforcement tries to pursue this kind of problem, how they are different in Europe. And perhaps are there some things that law enforcement here in the United States can learn by looking at the way the Europeans operate and the rules under which they operate. Our guest for this part of the program is Jacqueline Ross. She is associate professor at the University of Illinois College of Law and is right now working on some comparative study of undercover policing in the United States and also Italy, Germany, and France. And she teaches here in the areas of criminal law and criminal procedure, among other things. And we're pleased that she could be here and spend some time talking with us on the program. Questions, too, are welcome, and I know that she will do her best to answer whatever questions people might call in with. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and we do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, questions and comments are certainly welcome. The only thing that we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief, and we really just ask that just so we can keep the program moving along and get in as many different people as possible. But, of course, people who are listening, they are welcome to call. Thanks for being here. We appreciate it.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Is there, Sam, I don't know if this is too sort of general a kind of a question to start off with, but if you say if you look at the general philosophical basis, you know, what underpins the way that American law enforcement works and law enforcement in Europe, or at least in the places that you're really familiar with works, is the mindset really different that you actually start with in the two places?
Well, one big difference between the way in which terrorism and crimes in general are fought in the United States and between the ways in which those kinds of crimes are dealt with in Europe is that in the United States, we're very comfortable using undercover investigations to investigate organized crime, to investigate terrorists, to investigate drug gangs. We make frequent use of all sorts of undercover agents, informants, all different forms of infiltration. In Europe, that's viewed as much more problematic. There's been much greater hesitancy about using infiltration or undercover policing as a tactic against crime, although it has a longer history in Europe as a tactic against domestic terrorism. It started really in the 1970s when there was increased domestic terrorism, for example, in Italy and in Germany. And undercover policing then started with the intelligence agencies and to some extent the police, but mostly the intelligence agencies in those countries trying to infiltrate terrorist organizations like the Red Brigades in Italy or the Red Army faction in Germany. And from being used as a tactic against domestic terrorists, it gradually became to be used more against drug dealers as well. For example, through undercover buys of drugs from suspected dealers. But that was a relatively late development in Europe compared to the United States, where we've been doing undercover investigations since the 19th century and through much of the 20th century.
Hmm. Well, that's interesting that there would be a hesitance, that there would be the difference and there would be this hesitance in Europe, because I would think that if what you were doing is you're trying to penetrate some kind of criminal organization, no matter what the aim of the organization is, whether it's dealing in drugs or whether it's terrorism, that and particularly if what you're trying to do is, if you're not so much pursuing crime after the fact, that what you're actually is trying to do is prevent a crime from occurring in the first place, which is certainly the case with terrorism, then I would think that one of the best tools that you could possibly have would be to try to have your agents be undercover and to try to penetrate these organizations so that you would know about what they were planning on doing before they did it. That would seem to be sort of a natural kind of tool, in addition to other kinds of surveillance that you could do and wiretapping and you know, that kind of thing. Why was there that kind of hesitance about using undercover operatives and trying, in fact, to get people into these organizations?
Well, the hesitancy in Europe about using undercover policing stems partly from World War II, and in particular Germany and Italy, countries which have a fascist past, have the memory of the ways in which a totalitarian regime abused the police and centralized powers and surveilled people extensively, used informants within the civilian population to learn about people who were dissenters. And so I think partly because of that history, there's a real reluctance to use a technique that's associated in many people's minds with totalitarian regimes. And it's only, I think, with the resurgence of terrorism in the 70s that governments started to recognize the utility of undercover policing precisely as a way of finding out in advance what crimes were being planned, what attacks were being planned. One of the reasons, though, why it's harder in some countries, for example, in Germany, to use undercover policing purely preventively is because the police have a very limited role to play in preventing crimes. That is, they have a responsibility for preventing crimes, but the criminal code is not supposed to be used for purposes of prevention primarily. The criminal code and criminal investigations are primarily supposed to be used to gather evidence of ongoing crimes. And there is a separate code that varies state by state in the federal German system governing their preventive powers. And it used to be that the federal criminal code did not provide at all for undercover investigations, for undercover criminal investigations, and that it was therefore not clear whether information that you obtained in a preventive investigation could be used as evidence once people were arrested. And so one of the difficulties then of undercover policing in Germany stems from the fact that, A, they don't really have much of a preventive responsibility, and B, that really it's the intelligence agencies, the domestic intelligence agencies in Germany that are charged with preventing terrorist attacks primarily. It's their responsibility. Increasingly, the police now have gotten that responsibility as well. They share it now with the domestic intelligence agencies. But one effect of having in the past given that responsibility primarily to the domestic intelligence agencies is that the domestic intelligence agencies were the only ones who were supposed to run complicated undercover investigations of terrorist groups. Mm-hmm. But because of the constitutional principle of separation between intelligence and police in Germany, the intelligence agencies couldn't really cooperate with the police, work together on these kinds of undercover investigations. And because their job wasn't to solve crimes, very often the crimes that they learned about never made their way into the criminal justice system.
Yeah. Here in the United States, certainly since 9/11, there has been increasing concern about the threat of terrorism and a lot of debate about what we do, how do we meet that. And a very important concern is balancing people's expectation of a right to privacy with the need of law enforcement to continue to try to gather information on potential crimes. And people seem to be, maybe to a small extent, getting used to the idea that there is more surveillance than of their activities, at least in public, than there had been in the past. And this is the kind of thing that there's been a lot of controversy and a lot of debate here in the United States. I'm sure it has been in the UK. And I wonder about in Europe as well, and whether people have the same kind of expectation of privacy, and not just in their private life, but in public spaces that we do here in the United States. And is that the kind of thing that people argue about or worry about?
Yes, there's a much greater concern in Europe than in the United States about privacy expectations in public spaces. That is, people have a right under German law, for example, to prevent the publication of nude photographs of themselves that are taken in public. They have a right to control their image and the face that they present to the public. And that means that their intellectual property rights are different. It also means that, in general, that if a person is going to be surveilled long-term, even in public, that requires a warrant in Germany, does not require a warrant in the United States. So I think there are greater expectations in the legal system and in general in the population of privacy in public areas and privacy in private areas. There's one important difference, though. It's easy to think that if they did less undercover policing in Europe, then it must be that we are less concerned about privacy. But I should point out that we probably do quite a bit of a lot less wiretapping than is done in many of the systems that restrict undercover policing. Turns out those are, in a sense, substitutes for each other. And systems that restrict undercover policing tend to do a lot more wiretapping, and systems like ours that are pretty open about undercover investigations don't require warrants and subject them to fairly limited regulation compared to other investigative tactics. Those systems, ours, are much more restrictive in general about wiretapping, that is, about electronic eavesdropping in homes and on telephones.
Well, we have a caller here to bring in the conversation. Why don't we do that in Urbana, where we are? This is line number one. Hello.
Yeah, I just have a quick question. Recently, I was watching a one of these crime documentary things, and I was surprised that at one point the criminal involved was caught because his prints were run through Interpol, and the person they were interviewing on about that took the opportunity to kind of boast that Interpol's database was the biggest. This is kind of tangential to your topic, but hopefully you'll have something to say about it, that Interpol's database was the largest in the world. And I find that kind of surprising, given all the bluster in this country about, you know, being pro, you know, pro-enforcement on so many fronts. And yet it's really Europe that seems to have the largest database. Could you speak to that at all? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay. Well, I'm happy to talk about that. The FBI has a pretty large fingerprint database, too. I don't know how it compares with Interpol's database. Both are fairly large. But, yeah, I wouldn't I would not say that Europe in general is less savvy than we are about collecting private data. They do, although there's a bigger debate about how to share those private data, to what extent they're going to be made available, for example, to private companies as opposed to law enforcement. So credit information is much more difficult to share in Europe than it is in the United States. But as for fingerprints, yes, I would say Interpol is very active in sharing that kind of information, obtaining it from different law enforcement agencies, different national agencies, and they cooperate closely with the FBI as well.
All right. Well, and other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Here in the United States, there has been a lot of criticism of the failure of the various units of the federal government that are charged with doing intelligence work and in investigation. The NSA, the CIA, the FBI, maybe also the people who do intelligence in the Department of Defense and so forth. There's been a lot of criticism of the failure of these organizations to work together, to exchange information, to share what they know. There's been these really intensive turf battles among them. And in fact, some people would make the argument that if they had been able better to communicate, one might have actually even prevented 9/11. But at the very least, they could communicate better. Now, if you take a look at, again, the records of the places that you're looking at, Germany, France, Italy, do they have those same kinds of problems? And do people there complain that, you know, whatever the governmental apparatus is for dealing with intelligence issues and national security, that the various parts of that don't communicate well with each other, and that's a problem?
That's a big complaint in Germany and in Italy. It's a big problem in every one of these systems that there are different police agencies. In France, there's a gendarmerie, which is run by the Department of the Defense. And then there's the Police Nationale, which is run by the Department of the Interior, Ministry of the Interior. And they, in general, don't get along very well, don't communicate very well. There's a lot of rivalry. Customs, the Customs Service, which is run by the Ministry of Finance, is again a law enforcement agency that has had trouble in the past connecting with a judiciary police, which is a branch of the national police. And the rivalries have actually, in the case of undercover investigations, led to national police arresting French customs agents for doing undercover buys or undercover investigations of drug cases because there were rivalries in which the national police wanted to do more of those kinds of cases and were very critical of the rules which the customs used to conduct those kinds of investigations.
And did they know that they were arresting customs agents, or did they think that they were criminals? They knew who they were and they were arresting them anyway?
Yes, they knew that they were customs agents, that they were undercover agents. And they arrested them anyway, partly because of turf battles between these agencies. And in fact, some of these were prosecuted later on and eventually acquitted. Eventually, a political compromise was reached. But the turf battles were so severe in France that they led to the enactment of a new law in 1991, which for the first time established a legal basis for undercover policing. The problem was that undercover policing was, strictly speaking, illegal in France before that, although everybody did it. And so one French police force, the National Police Force, arrested another police force, the gendarme or the customs agents, because they were doing undercover investigations, which were not formally legal, although the French police did them just as much as the customs agencies did.
So there's some kind of law that says if you're a police officer doing your duty, you have to identify yourself as such. You can't pretend to be something that you're not?
No, the law didn't prohibit pretending to be another person, but what wasn't strictly legal before 1991 was buying drugs undercover, which was, strictly speaking, an offense. If a normal person went out and bought drugs, he would be guilty of a crime. And so if a police officer did those same actions before 1991, the fact that he was doing so for law enforcement purposes undercover provided him with no legal protection. And that's why the police were able to arrest customs agents in France, because in fact the law didn't define what they could do, and strictly speaking, the actions weren't protected.
This is fascinating to me. How did that come about? In the first place, that you would have to actually pass a law that says, look, if you're an undercover agent and you're doing something in the course of your duty as an effort to pursue crime, and if in the course of those duties you do something that is against the law, that it's okay.
Well, they passed specific laws in Italy, for example, that defined undercover policing as a legal form of crime commission, so as a legal form of committing crimes, and that specifically exempted undercover agents from criminal liability for committing acts which would otherwise be criminal, such as handling arms, possessing drugs, handing drugs to somebody else, which is, strictly speaking, distributing drugs. Everything that they did in their ordinary undercover capacity would subject them to criminal penalties if there wasn't a specific exemption. And so what France did was, what Italy did, is pass laws exempting undercover agents from criminal liability. And that's effectively the way in which they legalized undercover investigations.
Well, now I'm curious. I want to ask about the United States. So has it always been somehow in U.S. law spelled out in a way that says if a police officer in the course of doing their duty commits what would be for anybody else a crime, for them it's not a crime and they're not liable to criminal penalties for doing that?
We have what's called the public authority defense, or a kind of immunity from criminal prosecution, or a defense to a criminal charge, but it's a blanket defense. That is, if an undercover agent, and that exists in all of the states, and it exists federally as well, if an undercover agent commits what would otherwise be a crime, but he does it in his law enforcement capacity for purpose of successfully ending an undercover investigation for catching a criminal, and he gets authorization from his supervisors to do that, then he is freed of all criminal responsibility. Now, the exemptions in Europe don't look like that. In Italy, they're very crime-specific. That is, there has to be an exemption for every particular crime, and it has to describe exactly what the undercover agent can't do and what he can do. So, for example, when an undercover agent buys drugs undercover, that's fine. There's an exemption for that. When he buys stolen art undercover, as an American undercover agent once did in Italy, for the purpose of helping the Italian government recover its stolen art, he was arrested, and there was no exemption from criminal responsibility, no defense. The statute didn't cover stolen art specifically. He was indicted, and this had to be dealt with through diplomatic channels, but the charges couldn't be dropped. And the mere fact that he got authorization is not a defense in Italy.
Is that the fact that the law, that's the way the law is in those countries? I guess I would suspect that that has something to do with concerns about police corruption and that the idea that a police officer might do something illegal, intending to do something illegal, and might then try later to make the argument that says, well, no, I wasn't really doing this illegal. I was going after bad guys. So you got to, you know, sometimes you got to do bad things if you're going to go after bad guys. But this was in the carrying out of my duties.
Absolutely. The big concern here is corruption. The Italian police has had a big problem with corruption. And one concern is that if you allow people undercover to live a fancy lifestyle or to engage in actions that would ordinarily be criminal, can't a person always claim that he was doing whatever he was doing for law enforcement purposes because he eventually wanted to arrest somebody, but he just hadn't gotten around to doing so? And one colonel of the Italian Carabinieri, whom I interviewed, who was in charge of training undercover agents, told me in his view, nobody should be undercover as a career. People should be undercover only for one or two assignments and then go back to their regular police duties because the temptation to earn money illegally was too great.
Very interesting. Our guest this morning, Jacqueline Ross, she is Associate Professor of Law at the University of Illinois in the College of Law. And among her interests, something that she's now working on is doing some comparative study of undercover policing in the United States and in Italy, Germany, and France. And that's what we're talking about in this part of the show. Questions are certainly welcome, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us. 800-222-9455. One of the things that I'm maybe a little bit curious about is it seems that here in the United States, we are starting to expect or maybe giving more responsibility to local police, the kinds of people that ordinarily would be concerned with local crimes and probably relatively small crimes and parking enforcement and all that kind of stuff, is that we're trying to fold them into the war on terror. Is it the case that in Europe that what would be the equivalent of the local police, the people whose primary responsibility would be, you know, community policing in a small area and relatively speaking going after small crime, not real, you know, big stuff, that also they're being pulled into this effort as well of at least trying to be more involved in surveillance and in keeping track of people and in just looking for people that might be engaged in these kind of activities?
Yes, I think both in Europe and in the United States, there's more emphasis placed on surveillance, on obtaining intelligence, and on using ground-level personnel, people who live in communities, are there regularly, and actually know people in the communities to do those kinds of tasks. But the problem with that, the problem we've experienced in Europe as well, is that one of the reasons why local police are so effective is precisely that they're there, they know people, people trust them, and they've built up relationships in the community. To the extent that they now have to look for illegal aliens or ask about somebody's immigration status or try to conduct surveillance or try to gather intelligence, local communities start to suspect them, to not trust them. The flow of information on which the police depend for information about ordinary crime dries up. And so there's a real cost to the police being more involved in enforcing the immigration laws and also being more involved in gathering intelligence.
Mm-hmm. We talked a little bit earlier about turf battles in a couple of different places. In you mentioned specifically Italy and France, and we were talking about the fact that here in the United States there are those kinds of concerns. And you said that, in fact, yes, in Europe the same sorts of things go on, and that, in fact, rival governmental branch, rival branches who do different kinds of law enforcement are not above arresting each other's officers if they think they're poaching on their turf, or, you know, who knows what that kind of thing goes on. I know one of the countries that you have been looking closely at is Germany. So talk a little bit about France, talk a little bit about Italy. Do the same things happen in Germany?
Well, in Germany, there's a big problem of coordination because the domestic intelligence services are completely decentralized. This was part of the post-war arrangement to avoid concentrations of power in an organization like the Gestapo. The notion was that every one of the 16 lender or states that make up Germany should have its own domestic intelligence agency. Now, the problem is that a lot of the organizations that they're investigating, of course, extend beyond state lines and, in fact, beyond national boundaries. So it turns out that often these domestic intelligence agencies are investigating the same people undercover without knowing of each other. They don't share information in order to protect their sources. So they often have informants who don't know of each other in the same organization. And one disastrous result of all of this fairly recently was that when a neo-Nazi party in Germany was being investigated, the government attempted to outlaw that party because certain kinds of neo-Nazi views are absolutely prohibited under the German Constitution. They brought a proceeding to ban the party. But it turned out during the course of the proceeding that 15% of the leadership of the party were informants. And every seventh member in the leadership of the party, in the national political leadership of the party, was an informant. But none of them knew of each other. In fact, much of the evidence that they produced, the propaganda, the writings, the music, were produced by informants in the leadership of the organization. And so it was very difficult to prove what was being done by the genuine neo-Nazis and what was being done by the informants. Even more difficult was the fact that some of these informants then actually had gone over and become genuine neo-Nazis. And the domestic intelligence agencies were trying to figure out who was an informant. They themselves didn't know. And then they were trying to defend themselves by saying, well, look, it's all right to use their statements because they went over to the other side. Mm-hmm. And the result of all of this was that the petition to ban the party failed. Because the constitutional court said there's absolutely no way that we can figure out how much of the party's activities were influenced by and tainted by government involvement. Mm. And the reason why there was such a large percentage of informants in there is because there were so many domestic intelligence agencies, each of which had to have their own personnel involved.
Well, that's an amazing story. And you could see, given the country's history, why they would take that kind of approach. On the other hand, you could imagine that at some point someone would get up in the parliament and say, This just doesn't work. This doesn't make any sense. That we really have to be able to have some kind of centralized effort to do this, because this, and I can imagine just how you could get up and point at that very story and say, look at this. This just doesn't make any sense.
Well, there is also a federal intelligence agency, but the problem is that it coexists with these 16 other ones. And so each intelligence agency wanting to preserve its sources, it's very hard to see how they can maintain their independent identity and still share information effectively.
Mm. Let's talk with someone else here in Urbana. This is line one. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm. Hi.
The term has come up a couple of times now, war on terror. And it seems to me that this paradigm isn't very suitable for what we contend with, that the groups we're opposed to tend to have a lot more in common with organized crime than they do with a military establishment, and that by trying to combat it with military strategies, we're not doing very well.
Well, the undercover policing is interesting as a strategic device precisely because it's really more of a criminal investigation device than one than a military one. It's precisely the tool that's used to fight organized crime. And in Germany and in Italy and in France, all the laws authorizing undercover policing specify that it should be used only against organized crime or against terrorism. So they, too, group those phenomena as similar threats, and they allow undercover policing precisely on the notion that you have to know who the participants in the organization are before you can effectively combat it.
And I would suggest that they're doing much better than we are.
Which countries are you referring to?
The Europeans in particular.
Well, they've certainly caught a lot of organizations. It's hard to say.
They've even convicted a few people.
Yes, they've convicted people successfully, and they've stopped a lot of terror plots. It's clear they're doing something right.
Before the Bush administration, in fact, that was our paradigm.
Well, we're still using infiltration and undercover policing. I would think even more now than we did before. But that's the domestic criminal enforcement branch of fighting terrorism. There is, of course, also the military wing, but that's a separate approach.
Yes. Well, it seems to me that these groups tend to be quite small, fragmented. Most of the groups we've encountered so far have been less than, say, 30 people, except I think for the group that carried out the bombing in Spain. Some have been as small as 4 or 5, and quite amorphous. The idea that this is a war seems to be to mislead the public, and while it could be quite attractive to a political group, that is, the waging of a war, it seems to me that this is better approached as a police matter.
Well, it's certainly treated that way in Europe, but I think also here to the extent that we have people in trying to infiltrate groups. Now, as you say, that's pretty hard to do when the groups are small. And when I spoke to police in France and in Germany, they all indicated one of the problems with trying to infiltrate somebody into these groups is that the people in the groups themselves only know the one, two, or three other people they're dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like a big it's not a hierarchical organization, so it's not like a corporation in which you just have to get to the top person and figure out who everyone is working for. They're very decentralized. So I think both here and in Europe, we're trying to infiltrate. But it's hard to do partly because we don't have people who have the language facilities or because these groups are very closed and suspicious of outsiders trying to join.
One of the notable successes was in the Philippines, where there were supposedly 11 planes that were going to be hijacked and used as, I don't know if they were just going to blow them up or if they were going to crash them into people. But at any rate, that was actually solved very largely by routine police work, where the perpetrator was caught, something else, and his laptop computer gave him away.
Yes.
Although it's been often claimed that subsequently the Philippine secret police used torture to extract information. It seems they got very little. It was the police, good sound police work, that solved the case.
Yeah, I think, well, one of the advantages of police work in trying to ferret out terrorism is that the police have a lot of local knowledge. They have they have connections to local communities. That means they get information from people about who might be a risk or what kind of organizations are forming or what the sentiment in the community is, what people are worried about. So I think the information, that the police have a lot of local information is what helps them. And then the fact that, as you point out, a lot of good police work, finding people who are committing other crimes can lead you to terrorism because a lot of terrorists have to commit crimes in order to finance their operations.
Well, I'm enjoying your talk. And
thank you.
I think should be a very interesting work that you're bringing out. And thank you very much.
Well, thanks. Well, and I certainly take the caller's point about how what you call things matters, and that I think a lot of people have questioned the language that we use to talk about dealing with terror. They say the war metaphor is completely wrong. That's just that's not the right way to do it. That it is much more going after terrorist organizations, and much more like organized crime. That's pretty much what what they are. They're organized. They're like organized criminal gangs, and that depending on what you call it, that's going to influence your tactics, what you're going to do. Do you now? Having said all that, do you think that in Europe that governments are much more likely to, you know, in one sense, governments will use a certain kind of language publicly, and they'll probably also talk about the war on terror. But in fact, that people in governments really will say, well, yeah, it really is a criminal matter, and it makes more sense to pursue it that way than some other way.
Well, the term war is a very loaded term, and it's been used, of course, also in the context of the drug war, right? We talk about the war on drugs, the war on terror. What does that term really mean? It suggests a military paradigm where what we're really using are ordinary tools of criminal enforcement, perhaps not so ordinary undercover policing, but those are still criminal procedure tools that are used that primarily or can be used by the police to gather evidence and to convict people. That is, to use a criminal paradigm rather than a military paradigm. What was the second part of your question?
Well, I'm just wondering if, in fact, in the way European governments talk about this, whether they really say that sort of up front, they would acknowledge the problem with the two paradigms and would say that, you know, yeah, in fact, the war paradigm is just it's just wrong, and we shouldn't be using those kind of terms, because if you do, then maybe we'll suggest one set of doing things where, in fact, it makes more sense to look at this as a criminal matter and address it through your police and your justice system and not through something else.
That's right. I think in Europe, the people are very loath to use the term war on terror. People are uncomfortable about it, especially in government, because what they're trying to do is to apply the criminal justice system. Mm-hmm. They're trying to arrest people. They're trying to gather evidence. They're trying to convict them. And that's really inconsistent with a military paradigm. So people, I think, in private do try to avoid that term, though sometimes it's used in public. But there is an interesting question here. When does the so-called war on terror, when does it become a war? And there is a kind of debate in the community that does undercover policing about what the rules are. Mm-hmm. And in general, in France, Germany, and Italy, the laws that exist to regulate undercover policing treat it as a way of gathering evidence, and therefore not as a military tactic, something that you use to convict a criminal. So on the order of somebody who's a drug dealer or an organized criminal, it's the same paradigm. But there have been other approaches. In Britain, for example, at one point a decision was made that the IRA could only be rooted out if it was thoroughly infiltrated with undercover agents. Now there, the rules that we observe that are observed in Germany, France, and Italy do not apply. That's a purely an intelligence operation. What that meant was the aim was not to gather evidence. The aim was not to arrest anybody. The aim was to kill people. The game was to gather information. The aim was to get intelligence for the intelligence services so that they can then launch more effective strikes, perhaps arrest people, but not necessarily using the information as evidence. Undercover policing taken to its extreme, as it was in the IRA case, meant actually that undercover agents were authorized to do anything that the real IRA members did, including blow up bombs, including kill other people, including, in fact, ferret out undercover agents or informants in the organization, people who were also working for the British. So it turned out that one of the top enforcers of the IRA, whose job it was, he was in the inner circle, whose job it was to identify informants and kill informants, was himself an undercover agent for the British. And he killed numerous other undercover agents, but he was so valuable to the intelligence service that they let him do that and they kept him in there. And it's been argued that that proved very helpful to the British in fighting the IRA. And that contributed ultimately, people claim, to the decrease in their power. So there, I think, a military paradigm was used, a notion that an undercover agent could do anything and that the results would justify the means.
Yeah. Our guest this morning in this hour is Jacqueline Ross. She is Associate Professor of Law at the University of Illinois College of Law. And we're talking about some of the work that she's done looking at undercover policing, particularly, comparing the way we do things in the United States with the way that they are done in Italy, Germany, and France. We have a couple of other callers here. We'll go next to Champaign County. This is our caller. Next, line number two. Hello.
Hi. I don't want to divert to the IRA too much, but that gentleman was actually found dead on his farm just a couple, 3 months ago, I guess, if it's
really
the same one you were talking about, second in command or something of the political branch.
Yes.
Yeah. Since you've been talking about the war on terror, one insight I had, I think, was that, we hear people make the criticism it shouldn't be a war on terrorism, and then they say, but we can fight the war on terrorism better. So they should, more consistently challenge the metaphor and then not turn around and say we can do it better. And I think that's one of the mixed messages that the loyal opposition is guilty of right now. But that is a bit of an aggression. Actually, what motivated me to call was to talk about the interaction between our undercover people. Since you've been in Italy and researching it there, you probably are getting the drift of this case of Al-Masri, who was kidnapped on the streets of Milan. And these agents who have been accused and have been indicted, and I don't think any extradition has gone ahead, but these guys were, and women were, living at the Ritz or something, metaphorically. They were living a very high life, and there's accusations back and forth that the Italians sort of winked at it, but I don't know if you have anything to say about that. The other thing that came up, and there's so many loose ends here, is this idea that the British, even in this last roundup of the what are we calling them? The liquid bombers, I guess, liquid sky attack. Many of them didn't have passports. They made their suicide videos, but it didn't look like they were ready to do it anytime soon. And the British, there's this allegation that they wanted to at least wait another week before to roll it up. But this has to do with the critique that the Bush administration is using all this undercover activity and the war on terror, quote unquote, as very cynically politically, that when they need a photo op, they'll roll it up. And 2 years earlier, just before the last election, there was a similar incident where the British and the Pakistani ISI were running this guy named Naeem Noor Khan. And this guy was the guy that the British had flipped, and he was in email correspondence with a bunch of Al-Qaeda's, and the British wanted to run him longer, and instead the then head of Homeland Security announced it in a big press conference, and that they'd gotten this guy's hard drives, and the British were just furious with it, but it was sort of just a stage drop. Now, I don't know, this is where the last caller was going, I guess, and I just agree with his remarks, and maybe I'm abusing or digressing, but it seemed like a logical digression to talk about this when you're talking about undercover, though it's not really what you wrote about.
Well, there's a lot here. You've given us a lot. Let's give the guest a chance to talk about it.
Now, these are very interesting questions which you've raised. The kidnapping, the Al-Masri kidnapping that you're referring to in Milan, involved it's claimed 11 CIA agents who kidnapped him, brought him to another country, and to a place where he could be tortured. Now, an Italian magistrate indicted or charged these 11 CIA agents. But the interesting thing to note is that even if they did actually receive authorization from the Berlusconi government to do this, this would not be a legal defense in Italy, because the fact that they were authorized by somebody else will not help them if the order that authorized them was itself illegal. So in the very decentralized system of criminal justice in Italy, a magistrate can decide that what they did was criminal, even though the government knew about it in advance, even if the Berlusconi government knew about it, and even if it was, in fact, a joint operation. So that's one of the one of the effects of a decentralized system in which the magistrates have great independence and can't really be overruled by a political decision made by the executive. Now, as for the timing of the arrests in Britain, it raises an interesting problem. This is a problem in every undercover investigation. When do you take it down? And the advantage of waiting longer is you show that the people were serious, you get more evidence, you catch people in flagrante doing their crimes. Isn't that the best evidence? But the risks with this kind of crime, too, are that somebody might succeed in getting on a plane with liquid explosives, might succeed in setting them off. What if some people aren't treating this as a trial run? So perhaps, I can't second-guess the judgment here, but perhaps there was a concern that if they actually allowed people to get on planes, one person might actually succeed in carrying something out sooner. Or perhaps there was uncertainty about when the actual crimes were going to be carried out. And maybe they just thought it was too risky to let anybody get on a plane if there was any chance that they might be carrying a liquid explosives. Even if they weren't planning to set off the liquid explosive, the very fact that they might be carrying it on board might have been thought to be too risky. So it's true, you get a lot better evidence if you wait longer, but the risk goes up. And the risk of not being able to catch everybody. So let's say maybe they chose this particular point because there were other people who were leaving the country whom they couldn't get later. So it's just very hard to make the judgment based on what we know, that it was too soon. And there's always the big question, if they had let it go on, would it have been too late? Now, about the public announcement, you raise an interesting question here. Certain public announcements that have been made in the press and that have been made by government officials have angered European intelligence agencies because they've disclosed information that would have been useful to them in pursuing leads. Now, one thing I noticed is that in the paper it mentioned that this was the result of an undercover investigation. I don't know whether it was necessarily intended by the British that this come out, because I imagine it might be a risk to the undercover agent if he's still around. It may help them identify him. Even if they later on figure out it was an undercover investigation, it may be harder to figure out who the undercover agent was if some time has passed. So there's always that risk in international cooperative investigations that somebody may say too much.
We are almost out of time. I have one more call, and I want to try to include here in Kankakee. So why don't we go there to our line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
To return to the term war, in the United States, the term war has, under the Constitution, a very certain and specific meaning. Does it serve any useful purpose in the United States to blur the distinction between what you have referred to as the military and criminal paradigms, and if so, what meaningful purpose might it serve? Thank you.
I don't see really what the term war brings us other than the expression of a determination to prevail. But it's not clear what it would mean to prevail against organized crime or against drug traffickers or against terrorists in the way that we prevail against an army in the field. So yes, I don't quite see what the term really gives us if we want to keep those paradigms separate.
We're at the point here. We have maybe a minute or two left, and I'm always doing it this at the end where we really don't have time. I'm launching into some new big subject, but I guess I'm curious. Has there been a lot of controversy in Europe about the tactics of interrogation that might be used? Say that you have someone and you think that they have some information and they don't want to give it to you. What it is you're allowed to do to try to get them to give it to you?
There's a lot of debate about this, and Europe is in the press about this just as much as we have been. In fact, an Amnesty International report really recently cited France as the only European country that engages in torture with some frequency. But there's a big debate going on about permissible interrogation methods. And in Germany, this came to the fore when there was a big kidnapping case. A young child, son of an industrialist, was kidnapped. And they caught the kidnapper, but they hadn't found the child. And the question was, what methods could they use in interrogating him? And the police chief made the decision that he was going to not torture him, but simply threaten to torture him. And when, in fact, what he said to him was, well, you know, we don't use torture in the German police, but there is an old Nazi who knows how to inflict pain in all sorts of ways that we don't know anymore, and he's flying in from Dusseldorf, and when he gets here, all bets are off. And at that point, the kidnapper told him where the child was located. They found the child, but the child was already dead. But there was a big debate then. What happened is that the police chief was prosecuted for this, for threatening an impermissible interrogation tactic, lost his job. I don't know whether he was eventually convicted or acquitted or whether he was pardoned. But there was a big debate about what kind of interrogation tactics were permissible. And this wasn't actually the use of torture. This just concerned the threat of torture that was never planned.
Hmm. Well, we're going to have to wrap it up there because we're here at the end of the time. Our guest, Jacqueline Ross, is Associate Professor of Law in the U of I College of Law. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.